From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we conclude our week of looking back at some shows from 1987, the year we went daily as a national broadcast. We'll hear today from Sam Charters. He's a blues and jazz historian who will talk about leaving his home in the North to discover and record the music of the rural South. Also from 1987, we hear from Robert Murphy, an anthropologist who turned himself into a research project after being diagnosed with a debilitating tumor that left him paralyzed from the waist down. And all the way back from 1985, we visit with novelist Richard Price before he wrote the screenplays for The Color of Money and Sea of Love. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today is the actual day of the 20th anniversary of the national daily broadcast of Fresh Air. We've been commemorating that anniversary all week by playing back some of Terry's interviews from 20 years ago, and we have more of them today. We even have one that predates the anniversary. But for starters, we have Terry's 1987 interview with blues and jazz historian Sam Charters. He's one of the people who helped make possible the blues revival of the 1950s and 60s. Some of the musicians who were at the forefront of that revival first had their work brought to the public by Charters. He's a white northerner who, as a young man, became fascinated by southern black music. During most of the 50s, he was based in Louisiana and traveled around the South making field recordings of forgotten or previously undiscovered performers. He's produced hundreds of albums of folk and blues, including this 1968 recording of guitarist and singer Buddy Guy. In the mid to late 60s, Sam Charters was the head of A&R at Vanguard Records, where he produced the great anti-war hit, I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die Rag, by Country Joe and the Fish. When Terry spoke to him in 1987, she asked Sam Charters how he was first introduced to blues and jazz.
I'm one of those people who grew up in a family that had discovered jazz in the mid-20s. My father and my uncles had played in an amateur high school band. And in 1926, they were playing at a little lake in Michigan, playing arrangements of dance songs of the period. And someone said to them, well, you guys are okay, but you should hear the band at the next lake. So they went up to the next lake, and there was the Hoagie Carmichael Band playing jazz. And my family to this day has not recovered from it. And they instantly became jazz musicians. And so I just grew up with all of this. One of my aunts married a trumpet player who'd come out of Electra, Texas, with the whole Ray McKinley and that group. And so people would check in the house. Teagarden would be there hanging up on the clothes hanger because he was too drunk to stand up. And there were band rehearsals going on. And my uncles would disappear, and they would go off and turn out they'd hitchhike to New York to see who the latest trumpet player was in the Duke Ellington band. And I assumed everybody lived this way. At the same time, they were deeply involved in Béla Bartók's music, and they were deeply involved in theater. And there was just all of this going on. My uncles, when they were trying to court a girl, would play Bessie Smith records for them, which didn't go over very well, but they certainly went over very well with me. And it wasn't until I was really in my late teens that I discovered that what I'd had as a background was really very, very unusual.
Well, you spent your life in search of music. In the 1950s, you moved from the North to the South, based yourself in Louisiana, and started making field recordings of Southern blues musicians and singers. Why did you want to go specifically to the South, and why were you interested in blues? It was jazz that you were brought up on.
That's right, and absolutely, if you were interested in jazz at that time, New Orleans was the city to go because it was still alive. I began playing clarinet with my own jazz band when I was 13 and really wasn't very good and was looking for models, and I always was very determined if I wanted to do something, I did it. So I went to New Orleans as a teenager and looked up a man there named George Lewis. And George, for $5, would let me sit in the kitchen with him, and we'd play two clarinet duets for hours. And we'd play a tune like High Society, and I'd play the melody, and George would show me 30 ways to play the chorus. And I'd read every word that you could read about jazz, and since I'd grown up with it, I thought I knew a lot. And then one day I met George on the street in the French Quarter. He was with Jim Robinson, this wonderful trombone player, George and Jim, and they were all dressed up. And I said, where have they been? They'd been to a funeral. Who had died? A trumpet player. I said, wonderful trumpet player, Big Bammet, trumpet player from the 20s. I'd never heard of him. And I'd read every word on jazz that had ever been published. So that night when I went to see George before the job, he always rested, so he was lying in his bed resting, and I sat at the foot of the bed, and he began telling me about all the history of jazz that we'd never known anything about. And suddenly I realized that this is what I was going to try to find out about. So for the next 7 years, I lived in New Orleans, on and off traveling at the same time, interviewing all the musicians, the black musicians who'd ever played there.
Did you have specific musicians you were going in search of, maybe musicians whose records you had on 78 RPMs and who'd never been heard of for the past 30 years?
Well, the ones I was looking for hadn't even been recorded, most of them. In New Orleans, it was all legends. You knew that there was someone Louis Armstrong had learned from, and you'd heard Louis, but who was the one he'd learned from? Buddy Petit, and Buddy Petit had never made a record. So it became a wonderful, intense search for ghosts, looking for men who died many years before, trying to catch an echo of what their music must have been like. I tried to find every living member of the first jazz band, the Muddy Bolden Band, trying to get them to hum me their trombone parts, hum me the part that the guitar player played, trying desperately to get to something that was lost, something that was lost forever. But we still had a chance to get a glint of it, get some little memories of it somehow or other.
What kind of equipment would you take with you when you were going to record somebody performing?
When I first started recording, this is marvelous, it becomes sort of like the history of early photography. People don't realize the struggles we had. The early machines in the late 40s, which I couldn't afford, were simply wind-ups that had a heavy flywheel and always ran down. And then you could possibly get a new thing called a wire recorder, but they got all tangled up and had very low fidelity. And then you could get tape recorders, which was brand new. So I bought my first tape recorder in 1953, one of the very first cheap models. Had a little green eye that blinked at me. And the eye closed when I played two things too loudly on it. And it must have weighed, sometimes I thought it weighed several hundred pounds, but I carried the damn thing for 5 or 6 years, and I did 35, 40 records with it. I had a microphone that I stuck with me, and I hitchhiked around with that damn thing. And it wasn't until finally I went to Africa in 74 that I was able to take a really good battery-operated stereo tape recorder with me.
Well, you were traveling around the rural South. Did you always have electricity to plug the tape machine into?
In 1954, I'd heard of a group called the Mobile Strugglers, which was one of the last real, genuine skiffle bands in the South, playing with washboards and washtub bass and everything. So I went over, and I was very inexperienced, but I had my tape recorder, and I managed to get the washtub bass player out of jail, where he'd gone from drunk and disorderly, and managed to track the guys down. We were in a little shack neighborhood outside of Mobile, back in the sort of the woods, and I was looking for some place to plug in my tape recorder, because I had to plug it in, and the fellow said, "Well, there's a house right there. I know those people. We'll go in there." So we went in and, of course, plugged in and everything, and I used the people's ironing board for the microphone stand. Of course, they didn't know anybody lived there. We'd simply broken into somebody's house. And the people came in later in that afternoon, and here was this recording session going on with the tape recorder, and by that point we'd managed to find some beer. I was incredibly embarrassed, but they were very, very kind about it. They understood, danced along with the playbacks. We had a great afternoon.
You've also discovered musicians who no one, aside from local people, knew about before.
Oh, yeah.
One of them was Lightnin' Hopkins.
That's right.
Who's very familiar, I think, to people who listen to blues now. How did you first hear about him?
Well, it was impossible to not hear the blues as a jazz musician, even though we tried to keep the two separate. As early as the late 40s, the jazz groups I was playing with, we had one or two blues records that we would listen to, even though we knew nothing about it, nothing. And I heard over the radio. I was part of the black community in the early 50s, and the radios were on, and I'd hear Lightnin' Hopkins, who was a figure somewhere out of Texas, who was making some records for a funny little record company called Gold Star, which then went out of business. Lightnin' disappeared. But I always ate in a same sort of rundown restaurant in the French Quarter. And turned out, I was talking one day about Lightnin' Hopkins, and the cook said, "That's my cousin." And he at least directed me to Houston. And then once I got in the Houston ghetto, after about 3 days of asking around, I found a sister who didn't know anything. Found a place where his guitar was in pawn. They didn't know anything. And finally, I was sitting in my car at a street corner, and a car pulled up beside me, and a man rolled down the window and said, "You looking for me?" And I said, "You Lightnin'?" And he said, "That's right." So I rented a guitar for him, got a bottle of gin. We went back to the little shabby room where he was living, and we made his first LP.
What was it like?
was marvelous. I'd never heard anything quite like it in my life. Lightning went on and did hundreds of records, some of them losing the intensity. But for me, this was the first time he'd had a chance to stretch out without time limits, to simply do a range of songs. He wasn't having to worry about starting on time, stopping on time. I was sitting there with the microphone right in front of him, so he could simply be free. And he'd always been working with an electrical guitar, and I'd rented him an acoustic. So he was playing with music he was hearing himself in a marvelous way. And for me, I'd come closer, I think, to the genesis of the blues than I'd ever come before, because Lightning was such an extraordinary artist.
How old was he at this time?
Lightning would have been, been 49. I think born 1910, I believe.
Now, we have a recording standing by of Lightning Hopkins. Yeah. Is this from that first session?
That's right.
That
is from the first song he did, the Penitentiary Blues, where he took the old work song about Ain't No More Cain in the Brazos and turned it into a blues.
Penitentiary Blues. Big Brad is here come. Big Brad is here I come. You know I'm gonna do time for another man. When it haven't been a thing poor Lightning done. They say you ought to been on Brad 19 and 10. Buddy Russell drove pretty women just like he did. Ugly miss, I'm Big Brad. Oh Lord, yes, here I come. Finna do time for another man, and ain't nothing poor Lightning done. Well, you ought to be ashamed.
Lightning Hopkins recorded in 1959. I guess when you were recording this session with Lightning Hopkins that you weren't disappointed.
I couldn't believe it. Absolutely couldn't believe it, because I had, in all these years, been looking for the beginnings, been looking for the roots, which meant I was always working with older musicians. And quite often, even when they were playing for me, I was only getting a memory of what they had played like when they were young. And this was the first time I'd met someone really just at the height of his creative powers, that someone who had the imagination, had the flow and the vitality.
Sam Charters, speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1987 interview with musicologist Sam Charters.
You were living in the black community in Louisiana and traveling in black circles in the South. This was the 1950s. The South was still segregated. You must have really stuck out a lot, one of the few people probably in black circles at that time, and one of the few white people in black circles in the South at that time.
It was always complicated because... racism was an official policy of these small communities. It wasn't that simply people were prejudiced. It was simply the law. I was arrested a lot. I was picked up a lot. And I was scared a lot. Every person I talked to was immediately questioned by the local sheriffs, the deputies afterwards. I remember I was looking for Robert Johnson in Mississippi, and I talked to a couple of people on the street in just one of the little towns there, Friars Point. And I got down to the end of the corner, and I was looking at my map, and I looked back, and a deputy had both the persons I'd talked to up against a tree. And all I simply asked them for was directions. But I was not a car they recognized, and I was white. Only wanted. So I always had to be very careful, not only for my own sake, but for the sake of the people I talked with. In New Orleans, it was quite literally illegal for me to shake hands with a black musician on the street. And the streetcars were still with those damn signs you moved up and down saying white, black, you know, segregated, and you had to move them up and down. And if you tried to do anything against it, you simply got people in trouble. And so when I'd go with the musicians into a bar, they'd always have to, into a black bar, they'd always have to pass me off as a full-blooded Indian. They may look white, but he's a full-blooded Indian.
Well, that comment that you just made reminds me, too, that I wonder if you've ever felt at times like you were in an awkward position with a black musician you were recording, because especially in the 1950s when you were finding people who were really down on their luck a lot, who were poor, who hadn't, no one knew who they were, no one knew about their talents. They'd been in and out of prison, maybe. So you're coming from a more, you know, advantaged, privileged background. You have the money to give them and so on. It's not exactly a position of equality. And when you have this political sense that you're that's motivating your work, mm-hmm. you can really feel the unevenness of a relationship like that. How would you deal with that?
Well, there was no way to deal with it, because there was no way that they could understand enough of me or my background to in any way comprehend the complex nature of this. And also, they were very religious, most of them, and deeply conservative politically, and that here was someone who was essentially a-religious and rather radical, coming down and doing this for his own reasons. So they simply regarded me as a white recording boss. And the only possible relationship most of the time was that. And of course, there were. I was endlessly trying to make it friendship, but it couldn't be. You know, it would have been. Some of them wonderful ones like Big Joe Williams and things, they totally understood that they totally didn't understand.
Have people who've read your books, especially your new book, or heard your records, assumed that you were black?
Most do. And this has been difficult. It's been such a difficult point that for part of the 70s, I decided I would do no more work in the field of black music. So I didn't do anything from 70 until 73, expecting that a young black scholar would step in and do this kind of historical work. But because of the sensitivity involved, none did. So back I went and started again. And there were a series of books in the 70s, again, documenting the blues, documenting black music. But no, I had always felt this kind of sensitivity. But I the only thing that really put it in perspective for me was after my first blues book came out, The Country Blues, I was at a party with the Folkways office, and there was Langston Hughes. And Langston was telling me how much he liked the book, and I said, Langston, thank you, but you could tell me so much more about the blues than I'll ever know. And Langston looked at me and said, tell me something about Schubert that I don't know. And I realized at that point that this is simply something to learn about, and that it didn't matter what color or what your background was. If you set out to learn it and you were open, you could learn. And so this has been my final justification for continuing to absorb myself in it. Absolutely, there may be nuances I miss, but after all these years, there are a lot of nuances that I get, and I'll settle for that.
Sam Charters, speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. We're celebrating Fresh Air's 20th anniversary today, listening back to programs from our first year as a national daily program. Here's another taste from that first year, recorded live in our studios. It's Dr. John performing a song by Hoagy Carmichael. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
It's not the pale moon that excites me, baby, that thrill and delights me. Oh, no. It's just a meanness of love. Your sweet
conversation. Baby, that stirs up my imagination. It's you, child, and the need is a love. When you, when you're in my arms, and I feel you so close to me, all my wildest dreams, baby, come true. And you know, sure enough, they do. It's not your sweet conversation, baby, that stirs up my imagination. It's you, child, and there's a need, there's a love for you. Baby, that stirs up my imagination. It's you, child, and the deepness of love for you. Baby, it's you and all the stars above, and the deepness of love.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel. In stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. And from Fox Searchlight, presenting Waitress, an uplifting comedy by Adrienne Shelley about a small-town girl with big dreams, in select theaters now. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a look at the culture of paralysis with the late anthropologist Robert Murphy. When he found himself paralyzed, Murphy became his own research subject. Also, we hear from Richard Price from before he became a well-known author and screenwriter as we continue our look back at the earliest years of Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley. This month, we're celebrating 20 years of Fresh Air as a national daily broadcast by listening back to excerpts from our first year. Our next interview, flashing back to 1987, is with anthropologist and professor Robert Murphy, who died in 1990. In 1972, his body began to twinge with muscle spasms that wouldn't go away. Eventually, doctors discovered a debilitating tumor growing on his spinal cord. Murphy was a professor of anthropology at Columbia University at the time his illness first appeared. As his condition worsened, his interest in the social and cultural consequences of paralysis deepened. He became the subject of his own field research and found that he belonged to a subculture that was socially isolated and feared by others. From the perspective of an anthropologist, Murphy wrote a book exploring the uneasy relations between the able-bodied and the disabled. It was called The Body Silent. Terry spoke to Robert Murphy when that book was published in 1987 and asked him about his condition at the time. He told her he had some movement and use of his arms, but was paralyzed from the waist down.
Since you can't really control your legs and have just a little bit of control over your arms, do you still feel like the owner of your body? Do you have a different relationship with your body than you used to?
My body is now something about which I'm self-conscious. I am aware of my body, I'm aware of its deficiencies, and I'm aware all of the time. And you don't get totally disembodied. There are times when one does get disembodied, one would wish to become disembodied, but I think that the problem mostly is you maintain a sense of body simply because it is such a problem at all times. But the body does become alien to you. It becomes a very faulty instrument on which your head is sitting.
So you think of your body as a problem?
It is a problem. It is a desperate problem. And there are times when one feels almost a sense of imprisonment. Every now and then, I get slight attacks of claustrophobia, of being locked inside a body that won't move. There's something else that goes with it, too. And I've tried to write of that. It is a very difficult thing to write about, though. And this is the fact that I can no longer dissolve my thoughts into movement. We do not realize the extent to which our thought processes are all tied up with various physical things we do. Our thinking is just as much a matter of speaking, arm movements and so on. All of these things enter into it. And there are times when we escape thought almost altogether by losing ourselves in movement. I live a life that is to a remarkable degree, contemplative and meditative. And I was never a terribly contemplative or meditative person before, but in a way that I never experienced earlier, I spend a lot of time doing nothing else but thinking for long, long periods of time. And I suppose this was the genesis of the book.
A lot of people see paraplegics as asexual. Has that changed your relationship with women because you're not going to be perceived as having sexual interest in them?
Yeah. For one thing, I think it goes beyond sexuality and asexuality and goes into a very fundamental kind of relationship between males and females. Only after I got in a wheelchair did I find out how deeply women have been socialized to be resistant and to be on guard with men. Now, I think that right now, for example, I found out this early in my time in a wheelchair, that women I didn't know would talk to me. They would smile at me. I would get in the elevator. They would strike up a conversation. These were things that ordinarily no woman ever did before. And I sort of have enjoyed women more myself.
That's very interesting.
That at last I can talk to people of the opposite sex without there being somehow or other a worry in the back of each of our minds about what we're going to say. I can even talk to them about sex it doesn't arouse any anxieties.
Have you ever asked, why me?
No, I haven't. I think that's a useless question because there you are trying to impute some absolute meaning to the universe. Why me is absolutely immaterial. I look upon this as total caprice and without any ultimate meaning, and I don't think that I don't think that God is trying to punish me or do anything else, and nor do I think that any deity is going to cure me. So, no, it's been a very secular experience for me.
You know, in a strange way, Do you think maybe you've found your calling by studying the handicapped from an anthropologist's perspective? I just don't think any book has ever been written like yours, exploring what it feels like, both mentally and physically, to be handicapped.
You know, it is almost eerie. I started off my career very early as a student of large-scale structures and the evolution of society in general, all the way from primitive hunters and gatherers right on up to modern civilization. Somewhere in middle life, I didn't give up on that. I just became disinterested, and I became more concerned with the kinds of interactions that go on with people. Then that became a little bit stale, and I realized that what I had to do was find out what is the hardcore I that does the interacting. I always thought that if I ever was going to do this, how would I go about getting the research material? Then all of a sudden this happened to me, and the research material is now here. It is in me, it's growing on me, and fundamentally I found it was the direction of all of my research. And I now am asking the basic questions of what is the nature of being oneself, and what is the nature of basic relationships with other human beings. And it's been this has been the most fascinating part of the entire venture. It hasn't made it worthwhile. I do wish that somebody else had written this book.
Robert Murphy, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Murphy, speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. He died in 1990. Coming up, an interview that predates even our anniversary date with author Richard Price. This is Fresh Air. All the interviews we've replayed this week have come from 1987, the year Fresh Air started on NPR as a national daily broadcast. But before that, Fresh Air was a local show in Philadelphia with a weekly edition produced for NPR. This next interview with Richard Price is from that series. It was in 1985, before Price had written the screenplays for The Color of Money, Sea of Love, and Mad Dog and Glory, and long before he wrote the novel Clockers and worked on HBO's The Wire. His novel The Wanderers had been published, though, and so had The Breaks, a novel written the year before Price spoke with Terry Gross.
The character in The Breaks is the first character, main character, in any of your novels to have actually finished college. Most of your novels are about characters who come out of working class, lower middle class neighborhoods in the Bronx. Were there a lot of writers writing about those kinds of neighborhoods when your first novel was published?
Well, if there were, the novel might never have gotten published. This is something that I usually say about that the whole situation of me trying to be a writer in that kind of environment. I mean, I don't want to romanticize the poverty or something. It was basically, you know, working-class neighborhood. What happens, though, in a working-class neighborhood is that the parents are children of people that try to scratch livings out of the Depression. So my parents were kids during the Depression, haunted by economic survival. And if it was in the 60s and you were the first kid in that family to go to college and you wanted to do something in which there was no blue chip guarantee of a professional job at the end of the education, they thought you were nuts. So the brightest minds of my housing project and millions of housing projects like that across America, I would guess, would go to engineering school or medical school because there was a job. If you were going to Cornell like I did and your father's putting the money together for you to go and you want to be something like a poet or a painter or a dancer, they would look at you're like you were mentally defective and you were wasting their money. So it was very hard for a kid to get the validation to do something creative. Myself, I was so psyched out by that thinking that even though I wanted to be a writer, I got a degree in labor relations.
Just so you could
just because I didn't
do the right
feel like
thing.
Well, I thought, well, gee, maybe writing could be a hobby, you know, and then it sort of took over when I was in college.
It seems important for all of your characters to get out of the neighborhood and to break away from the family, but it's really difficult for most of them to achieve that. Mm. Were you in that kind of situation? Was it hard for you to get out? Was college your ticket out?
I used to think it was just a matter of like getting away from the family or some doctrinaire attitude about, you know, the politics of, you know, families smothering children or economic survival. I think it's more like this general feeling I had all my life, which I think a lot of people have, which is, where is it? You know, it's like you're looking for it and you're trying to escape something because what you're doing now, there's an old Lord Buckley routine where there's a conquistador. Lord Buckley was a jazz comic in the early 50s, and he had a routine about Cabeza de Vaca, where a conquistador was looking for India, wound up in St. Petersburg, Florida. And what he said to his troops is, we didn't know where we was, but we knew where we was wasn't it. And I think what I've been writing about is that feeling of like escape. It's not the family, it's not the economics, it's something intangible. And I've just come to, I used to think it was something tangible, like economics or family, but it's really, it's that feeling of like, because I still feel it, no matter what you have, you're over here, but it's over there. And the minute you're over there, it's over here. You know, and it's that zip-zip roadrunner game that you play with something that you can't get a hold of that I think I've been writing about all along.
But it's interesting, once you got out of the Bronx and you actually started writing, what you were writing about was the thing that you left, which was the Bronx and family.
Well, that's the only way. I mean, what else can you write about? The reason, well, I mean, I used to teach writing, and I don't think you can write about anything if it's if you're surrounded by it, because you can't see the forest for the trees, to use a cliche. When I went away to college, my life changed so radically. And I knew I was never going to go back. And it was something in my life finally that had the end attached to it, which a lot of young writers don't have because there's not that much that has finished in their life. And I had gone, after Cornell, I'd gone to Stanford, which I'd never been out of New York State in my life. And I knew whether I liked the Bronx or didn't like the Bronx, it was over. It was a part of my life that was over. And it would only exist as long as I could remember it. And it had nothing to do whether it was good or bad. It was just a part of my life that was finished. And out of that panic of losing a part of my life, I forced it to crystallize, you know, to write it down just before it escaped, you know, and I got senile or something.
Once you left the Bronx and you were with other people who weren't from the Bronx, did you start mythologizing that into something maybe larger than it was or different from what it was?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was sort of mythologized at more than me self-promoting the fact that I was Bruce Springsteen or Lou Reed or something like that. I mean, I think what happened is that basically I was a Jewish working class kid and I wrote about Italian kids because I had felt sort of psyched out because I felt, what could I say after Philip Roth or after Michael Gold or somebody like that? So I thought, and I knew, you know, I grew up in a housing project, which was pretty eclectic, and it's collection of people. It was truly integrated. So I was rubbing elbows with everybody, so it was just as easy for me to write about Italians. But what happened is when the book came out, I became the first person since James Farrell wrote Studs Lonergan or Hubert Selby wrote Last Exit to Brooklyn to get down into grits and the depth and everything. So everybody assumed that I graduated from Odyssey House, as opposed to college, or, you know, I write with a switchblade, you know, and people were, like, scared of me. And it got to the point where they were kind of disappointed that I wasn't even Catholic, you know. I mean, people sort of wanted me to be this guy who wrote with his femur, you know, dipped in his victim's blood or something. You know, and I got kind of caught up in that, you know, because it's like I was 24 at the time, and, you know, you don't know whether to go to the bathroom or wind your watch half the time. When you're 24 and you're getting all this stuff thrown at you and you're getting, you know, you have a hard time knowing who you are, let alone getting this romanticized media thing thrown at you about yourself, and you start buying your own copy after a while. So then I started lying. I told people I was formerly Catholic, or, you know, I went to a different high school than I really did, you know. I went to DeWitt Clinton instead of Bronx High School of Science or something. But
did you develop a thicker accent?
Well, that happened not from writing The Wanderers. That happened because when I went away to Cornell up in Ithaca, New York, I felt so threatened by all these people who had real, like, Midwestern accents. If they came from Peru or Indiana, it was equally exotic to me because I had never met anybody outside. I thought the whole world was Italians, blacks, Jews, and Catholics. I never met a white Protestant person in my life before. And I felt very threatened by everybody else's sort of exoticism. So I think as a matter of survival, I sort of intensified my own exoticism, and I developed a worse Bronx accent in Ithaca, New York than I ever had in the Bronx because I never needed it before.
The first novel, The Wanderers, was about street gangs in the Bronx, teenage gangs. Were you ever in a gang? Did you have friends in gangs?
There's a comedian that I forgot the guy's name. I think it was, well, I don't know what his name is, but he had this thing that he was in the Goldberg gang. And I said it was no real big deal. We'd walk down the street and somebody would say, "Hey, here comes the Goldberg gang." And somebody else would say, "Big deal, what are they going to do, algebra?" You know, that was kind of, you know. I mean, like I said, you know, I rubbed elbows with, like, tougher kids, you know, and nobody ever wants to be who they are. Everybody's, you know, kids want to be, like, athletes or, you know, like a Jewish kid wants to be James Brown. It's like, tell me I'm not who I am. Tell me there's something else out there.
What about being funny? Was that important too?
Yeah, sure. Sure. It was just a survival. It's just, you know, you want to stand out. You want to be different. Anybody who's a writer or a painter or anything in the arts is no portrait of mental health. I mean, I think one of the things above and beyond the desire to make art is this feeling of that it is intolerable to not stand out, to not be noticed, you know, and you're going to, when you're a kid, you're usually, like, really weird and on the edge of things, and you're a lemon. And then if you become a successful artist in some way, you've learned how to make lemonade out of the lemon that you were, you know. But what the underbelly of it is I have to be an artist. I have to take this loneliness and this perimeterhood and make it work, you know, because there's no way on earth that I could be, like, undistinguished. It's not a happy or a proud choice. It's a desperate choice.
Well, I hope you don't mind my mentioning this, but your right arm is... I don't know exactly what the problem is, but you don't have, I think,
full control over it. Well, I have cerebral palsy, and it's like a mild thing. It's like some people notice it, some people don't. But for me, since we're doing Dr. Freud, I think for me, what it was is that when I was a little kid, everybody treated me like different and special. It's like, what's wrong with your hand? What's wrong with your arm like that? And on one hand, it's kind of depressing, pardon the pun, it's kind of depressing, you know, to be noticed for that stuff, but on the other hand, you get hooked on everybody, you know, thinking of you as a little different, even though it's sort of a weird thing to be, you know. I just, for everybody, I think there's something. If I had sort of like a perfect Nazi android body, I think it would be something else. You know, just for me, it was just the hand. If it wasn't for the hand, it would be something else.
Richard Price speaking to Terry Gross in 1985. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's 1985 interview with Richard Price.
Your first two novels were about Italian families. The second two novels starred Jewish main characters. Why did you make the switch?
Well, I got tired of passing. you know, it's like imitation of life. I just realized, what happened is I realized that the people that I had to write about we're not the Portnoys, and we're not, you know, Sol Bello characters, or basically working class people. Not, I wasn't writing about the Jewish culture or the Italian culture. I was writing about working class culture, and the fact is that I did know working class Jews better than I did knew working class Italians. And as I got older, I became into myself a little bit more, and I felt less of a need. I was getting farther and farther away from that, wanting to be James Brown or wanting to be not me. You know, I felt, you know, you feel a little bit better about yourself. And I realized I had this, all this untapped territory. I wasn't writing about, you know, the oy 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 Jews, and I wasn't writing about the Jewish intellectuals living on West End Avenue. So I was neither Cynthia Ozick or Philip Roth or Bruce J. Friedman. I had a housing project, people that could either be Jewish or Italian. The Judaism was not that important to them. You know, if you look at the last two books, I mean, nobody goes to synagogue, or nobody talks about the Holocaust or something. It's like they're New Yorkers, really.
Did you listen to a lot of Lenny Bruce?
Well, yeah, Lenny Bruce is my hero in terms of, I think my two heroes in terms of writing were Lenny Bruce, in a funny way, and Hubert Selby, because Hubert Selby was the first time I ever read anything that was of my time that was in print. And so therefore I found my own experience as valid grounds for literature. Even though I might have been crazy about Oliver Twist, Oliver Twist didn't play in Epoxide Projects. And Lenny Bruce, the way he spoke and his pacing or his humor, and first my first exposure to Lenny Bruce is they had a book called The Essential Lenny Bruce, which is a paperback, which are just basically transcripts of his club acts. And I saw that on paper, and it was like 3D, the words. It was my introduction to like perfect, ear-perfect dialogue, because it was tape transcripts. And I never saw language. I never saw a page alive like that. So Hubert Selby told me it was okay to write about where I came from, and Lenny Bruce told me sort of how to talk about it.
There's a lot of rock and roll in your novels. Characters are always putting on records that are really important to them. What did rock and roll mean for you when you were growing up?
The same thing, well, pretty much what I said, which is escape. It's like, I'm not me, I'm Dion. I'm not me, I'm James Brown. I'm up there and I'm wearing these gold lamé tight pants with a satin cummerbund and flamenco heel shoes, and I've got 9 pounds of pomade in my hair, and I'm flipping a mic out 90 miles an hour every way to compass, and nobody has ever seen anything like this, and I'm covered with sweat, and I got a voice that could shatter glass in another zip code, man. And what it all boils down to is I'm not me. Thank God. Here we go. I had my ticket. I had my airplane ticket every time I put a record on.
Richard Price, speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. We've been celebrating the 20th anniversary of Fresh Air this week by listening back to some of our favorite interviews from our earliest days on NPR. It was 20 years ago today that we started the daily national edition of Fresh Air on NPR. I was part of that show, reviewing the finale of Hill Street Blues. How time crawls. That day also was Irving Berlin's 99th birthday. And on that inaugural National Daily Fresh Air show, we invited singer Peggy King to perform an all-Irving Berlin concert, accompanied by pianist Michael Abene. Here she is in the Fresh Air studios singing Always.
Everything went wrong, and the whole day long I'd feel so blue. For the longest while I forgot to smile, then I met you. Now that the blue days are past, now that I found you at last, I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true, always. When the things you've planned need a helping hand, I will understand. Always, always, days may not be fair, always. that's when I'll be there always. Not for just an hour, not for just a day, not for just a year, but always.
Peggy King, performing in the Fresh Air Studios on our very first broadcast 20 years ago today. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Sharrock, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. And from Fox Searchlight, presenting Waitress, an uplifting comedy by Adrienne Shelley about a small-town girl with big dreams, in select theaters now. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, forensics veterinarian Melinda Merck tells us about some of the animal cruelty cases she investigates for the ASPCA. Also, how to raise a healthy and happy puppy. A talk with best-selling animal behaviorist Nicholas Dodman. His new book is Puppy's First Steps. Join us for the next Fresh Air.